Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. I'm not done yet with Toronto, or Toronto is not done yet with me either way. And so one more episode of hits or misses, I guess we'll work through both of them. But it's a very special episode because I haven't had this guest on forever. So I'm quite happy that he could make time for it. Sam Adams, senior editor at Slate. Hello, Sam.
Hello, Dick. Thanks for having me.
Yes, I don't really know how it's been so long, because we actually cross paths at festivals and either vent about nothing or maybe about a film or two. So I'm glad to have you here.
As we will probably do on this very podcast, perhaps.
Indeed, yeah. Only this time we'll have it recorded for posterity. But I mean, this was, I guess, the first Toronto in person. I've already talked about that aspect of it on the podcast a bit. But I guess for you, you're a longtime attendee, but this one was a little different this year for you.
Yeah, I've been going for like 20 years or something like that. So yeah, obviously the last few years, the virtual years, the year when basically no one from outside Canada was allowed to come. Last year, when there were like 10 American journalists there, it was sort of back to full strength this year, which I was looking forward to. This is also the first year that I've been to Toronto after having been to Cannes, which really changed things for me significantly. The first day of TIFF for press screenings is sort of notoriously Cannes catch-up day. And there's often like 8 things scheduled at once that everybody wants to see. And this time I was picking and choosing much more freely, which was nice, but it also meant that I was not starting my festival with all the things that everybody saw in May that we already knew were great. So got to see more things, but saw less sort of surefire masterpieces this time around.
How does that change the festival's like general personality, you know, because it's generally a big tent kind of festival?
Right. It was less of a sort of festival of festivals for me this time, where I'm just kind of finally getting my first look at stuff that people have seen. So it was a little more discovery oriented, which is nice. You know, there is, however, that anxiety that sits in, depending on who you are. For me, quite quickly, just because of my general nature, where it's, you know, a day and a half in, you know, it gets to, certainly if it gets to like, you know, Friday evening or something, and you haven't seen something great yet, you're like, oh, this is a disaster. This is such a waste of time. I haven't seen one amazing life-changing movie yet. I might as well just have stayed home. Fortunately, that changed, but I did have a little while where I was like, ooh, this is not going as well as I would like it to.
Yeah, there's a peculiar type of existential panic that sets in when you're sitting in front of one sort of middling movie after another. But that definitely does describe one highlight from your viewing that I think you mentioned, and that is the new Jafar Panahi film, No Bears. And what did you make of it?
I thought it was great. And this is Jafar Panahi, his latest movie, which basically stars him as himself, as a filmmaker who is kind of remote directing a movie. He is relocated to a small village on the Iranian side of the Turkish border. He is directing a movie on the Turkish side of the Turkish border. But because he is, you know, at that point was sort of semi like under arrest or being very carefully watched by the government, he is now actually in jail, which is one of the things that obviously affects the context of this film. But at that point, he's just playing a filmmaker who is, you know, not supposed to be making movies, being very carefully watched. We start off seeing this film within a film that he's making, which is about two refugees kind of trying to find asylum, trying to get their way out of the country. And then the camera sort of pulls back from what we see as his MacBook screen to show Jafar Panahi basically, you know, directing this movie over FaceTime, and then losing signal in this remote village and kind of running around with his phone trying to get another one, which is a lot like Kiarostami's The Wind Will Carry Us. It becomes kind of like a running gag in this one, but there's more of a sort of existential vector to it or not, because it's his connection with not just the world, it's not just frustrating, but also his art. Like, he can't be present for the shoot either physically or virtually at that point. We then later find out that the actors in his film are also going through something similar personally and are sort of playing themselves in the film by this character who he's playing, who is also himself. So there are layers and layers and layers in this thing. They're sort of continuing the tradition that unofficially started for me with Memoria last year, which is a movie. It's very much about sound. where at the TIFF press screening, the sound started doing all sorts of weird things that I thought was this really, you know, sort of brilliant, like metatextual edge to the filmmaking. And it turned out that the surround on the DCP was just wonky. And in this case, the film just kind of started flickering out, went to pixelating and getting blotchy, then went dark for a minute, but the sound was continuing. I was like, oh, is this an interesting thing that he's doing? And then, you know, 10 or 15 seconds later, it was like, oh no, we're just going to have to take a break. But it is definitely, that is sort of a particular risk at a sort of occupational hazard at film festivals where these are movies that no one's seen before and maybe doing sort of, you know, weird or experimental things with the forum and you don't quite know what's an error and what's intentional. But, you know, this one especially kind of puts you in that frame of mind.
Yeah, I'd heard that there was a glitch in the DCP, and yeah, they had to stop it. And then when they restarted it, it was like a little further than where they had stopped it. Yeah. Or something like that.
Yes.
Which is highly anxiety inducing when you are basically, as a critic, like accountable for what you've been seeing and you're not being shown the whole thing.
One aspect of the movie I really like, I mean, Panahi is someone who's been very directly, you know, put at odds with the Iranian state. I mean, one of the things he was imprisoned for was kind of spreading propaganda against the state. You know, in the case of this movie, it becomes, it's sort of taking place in microcosm. It's just about the sort of unofficial, really, government of this tiny little town where they're convinced that in just, you know, shooting this local ceremony, he has inadvertently captured footage of a woman who's betrothed to another man, sort of being, you know, cozy with the man that she's actually in love with and might be running away with, and the man she is betrothed to, and various people keep coming up to him and demanding that he give them this photo that he's taken, which he insists that he has not taken. It seems like he hasn't, but it sort of, you know, becomes a little ambiguous. But eventually they're like, you know, listen, just, you know, I mean, they don't believe him for one thing. And he's like, here's my memory card. You can just look through it. And eventually he just gives it to him. But they just kind of keep coming after him. Eventually they're like, listen, just, you know, we have this little sort of traditional ceremony where you go to this, they call it like a swear room. You know, you go to this place and you swear that you never took this picture, you know, that you've never seen it before, and then everything will be okay. And of course he does that, and that doesn't happen either. So it's sort of in microcosm, the idea of government persecution just as this constant, like, pestering annoyance that prevents you not only from sort of making films, but just from living his life. And I think it really, really gets at, like, how draining just that kind of petty harassment can be as well.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible that effectively he's been, like, under a kind of sentence for all these years, and then they just put him in jail. So it entirely makes sense that he would put some of these aspects in the movie at this point. Is it too much of a spoiler to explain what the title is, or unless you mentioned it, I missed it?
It is not, only because it only sort of barely figures into the movie. You know, one of the things he is doing is he is kind of sneaking out of this village at night to take the road up to the border. And at one point he's being urged to cross it, both to take part in the film and effectively flee the country. And he kind of goes up in this hill, is looking into Turkey. And then, you know, the guide who's taking him there is like, you know, you're standing on the border right now. And he just goes... He freaks out and takes several steps backwards. But one of the things he's worried about driving around at night is that they have to, you know, look out for bears in the area. And as the title indicates, there are in fact no bears. So that's why it's no bears.
Right. Well, it's also interesting just about the border aspect, since his son's debut feature, Hit the Road, was about a family going to a border. I mean, there's a whole border drama there going on. So it's kind of interesting that crops up here as well. Now I want to ask about a movie that you said you'd like to talk about, but not because it was good. So that's obviously intriguing. And that is the movie The Menu. What is this about?
Okay, so The Menu is, based on the way it's been sort of positioned, I think it was sort of one of the big fall releases for Fox Searchlight. And it was directed by Mark, I believe it's Milud, who's, I think, best known for working on shows like Game of Thrones and Succession. And it is set up, it's this sort of satire of extremely high-level foodie culture. It takes place on this island, which is basically this tiny island that has this one restaurant on it that is run by this very famous, exacting, elusive chef played by Ralph Fiennes. I think it's about 12, let's just simplify and call them rich assholes, who have all spent $1,200 a piece to go and have the meal this one night. And as you might expect, things do not go particularly well for them. I guess I won't spoil it exactly, but you could tell that, you know, things are going to get unpleasant pretty quickly. And in fact, they do. And I had sort of been told by a couple of people who saw this in the early days of TIFF that this is like really great and this sort of sharp and funny satire. I saw some friends kind of compare it positively to Triangle of Sadness, which is a movie that I really like, but some people have accused of being too sort of glib or cozy in its satire of the ultra-rich and powerful, this being a movie that, you know, the people it's about, you know, could see and still enjoy. I mean, the fact that it's about, the entire movie takes place on a luxury yacht and it debuted at Cannes, where you were literally sitting facing a harbor full of luxury yachts as you're watching it, was an irony that no one, including me, when I wrote about it, failed to observe. So this, I mean, this is much meaner in some respects. I mean, you don't have, you know, a 10-minute scene of people, you know, vomiting up brightly colored entrees. But people do get their fingers cut off and, you know, set on fire and stuff like that. So it's, you know, much more deliberately assaultive on them, but it just feels really kind of glib and uninteresting. And even as someone who does not have a lot of $1,200 a head meals, I will confess, I have never spent that much on a meal in my life. But it, the satire of the foodie culture, there's jokes about, like, you know, sort of foam in cuisine, and I'm not sure if that was like 10 or 15 years ago, but it just feels really sort of easy and out of date and not particularly well informed.
Right.
So I was unimpressed by it pretty well across the board. You know, I think Ralph Fiennes' performance is pretty good in it, even though his character is not the most nuanced. But overall, this left me pretty flat, I would say.
Yeah, this is going to sound terrible, but it's sort of gotten to the point where Ralph Fiennes that I'm a little suspicious when he's in a movie. I don't really, it sounds terrible because that in some ways that was the opposite. Like, he'd be something I would be interested in seeing whatever the movie was. But like, at least since, I don't know, I want to say Grand Budapest. I mean, I guess parts of A Bigger Splash were interesting, but not the whole thing really. The intensity is just not there in the same way. I don't know.
I mean, I feel about him like I do about a lot of sort of canonically great actors, Meryl Streep and Cate Blanchett among them. It has just almost monotonous, the extent to which I will just say, like, I wish they would do more comedy. Mm. So I'm really, you know, I was looking forward to that in this, but actually his performance is, the movie itself is kind of too glum and spiteful to really let him indulge that too well. Mm. So yeah, I was unimpressed. I know other people really like it, and God bless them, but I'm not one of them.
Well, yeah.
Janet McTeer plays a kind of like sort of Anna Wintour of the food world in this, and I enjoyed her performance, but not a whole lot else.
I mean, for a movie like that, they really should, you know, provide a $1,200 meal to critics just to kind of, you know, let you understand it fully.
I mean, I will say to Fox Searchlight that I am still very willing to be corrupted on this movie. So if you want to set me up for a $1,200 meal, I will gladly reconsider my take.
Well, you're here. It's all recorded. So Glass Onion, and this is one that I did see. I don't want people to think that I just didn't see anything. But Glass Onion I saw with, I have to say, like an especially raucous, I think it was a press audience. They will at least have one more, I think, according to the deal that this is with Netflix. Clearly, they're setting up to have as many of these as they can. And it's Rian Johnson and, again, Benoit Blanc, played by Daniel Craig. And this time, the mystery is set on an island, and it is explicitly set at the outset of the pandemic at, you know, whatever that would be, May 2020. And it starts, you know, true enough to that period with people getting mysterious packages that are invitations to this island effectively, but are puzzles in themselves. So that, you know, there's a fun kind of rapid, clever opening to it. And then, you know, a series of introductions and a series of curiosities as they get on the island. And the island is overseen by Edward Norton as, I guess maybe he's supposed to be like a Elon Musk sort of.
He's a little musky, yeah.
figure, but also just can be generic, like obliviously too cool for everything, but not actually cool tech bro type person who is, yeah, just boundlessly wealthy. And this is his birthday party. but he's going to like stage some sort of murder mystery. And that's what's going to happen. And I should say, like, this is a movie that they've desperately tried, that they, meaning the studio, has desperately tried to keep critics from saying anything about. I remember as the credits were rolling, they switched off the audio of whatever soundtrack was still plunking along at that point to have over the PA reminding all of us not to say anything that might spoil the experience, et cetera, et cetera. Which I think if you're like a red-blooded critic, only kind of raises your hackles. But anyway, that's a general. Did I miss anything? I mean, obviously there's a kind of a fun cast, although I have to say maybe a little less fun cast than the first one.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I enjoyed this movie a lot. I was laughing a lot. I think, you know, Rian Johnson's a really kind of smart writer-director, and he does, you know, with this movie about what you would want from a sequel to the original Knives Out to do, which is just kind of take what he's done and build on it, square it a little bit, make the setup a little more absurd instead of a sort of typical, you know, haunted mansion like the first one. It's in this absurd island compound that is topped by this translucent control structure, which is the titular glass onion. And yeah, the characters are all even worse, horrible, rich people, just even douchier than the people in the menu. And it does sort of, having seen these two within a couple of days of each other, I mean, Glass Onion is really like, this is what the menu is trying to do. The cast is not up to the same level. I think, I'm sure the budget was much smaller as well, but it just kind of like, you know, zips along and sings in places and has lots of funny little jokes. There's a gag at the beginning. I won't spoil who is in it because I've already been chided by Netflix for doing this, but there's a gag at the beginning where, because it's during the pandemic, we first see Benoit Blanc in the bathtub playing Among Us over Zoom with a quartet of what I will just call notables in this case. So, which, you know, which really, I mean, I haven't thought about Among Us in a year and a half, but I certainly did some of it with my daughter in the beginning of the pandemic. So it's just funny and kind of sharp to go back to stuff like that. Dave Bautista plays a kind of men's rights YouTube influencer in this who refers to Google alerts as googs. And at one point, they have a sort of a running gag about celebrity products. So he's asking for a bottle of, I believe it's Jared Leto's hard kombucha at Edward Norton's house. And he just says, "Booch me." And if there's a more succinct way to establish a character as a complete asshole, I can't think of it. Like, it's just, you're done at that point. You don't need any more character. You know exactly who he is. So that kind of stuff is very enjoyable. It was about 40 minutes in. I was like really enjoying myself and also sort of starting to get like a little bit exhausted. I found, and maybe I need to see it, you know, again at some point when it's not my 14th movie in 3 days, but I think it may prove to wear people down a little bit as well. And it's a little bit long. The structure is a little bit odd in that it sort of gets up to a point and then there's a big, you know, flashback towards the beginning, and that sort of left me in a weird space as a viewer. But I enjoyed it a lot, and I think that's basically what it's there for.
Yeah.
It did the thing.
Yeah. No, same for me. I think it's a little long. I mean, it's almost an act of bravado that he just kind of keeps on going because he does have the skills to do it. I mean, it's kind of insane how few directors working on this level have this, like, what I thought used to be like a sort of fundamental ability to just keep the show going.
Right.
And, you know, that's a matter not just of like a clever script, which he can write, but also just of the camera movements or this, you know, the sequencing, the idea of like, yeah, hitting the reset button partway through the movie in a pretty interesting way, and all of that. And he's still able to do that. So I remain impressed by him.
Yeah, it reminded me of watching his Star Wars movie and just being sort of almost like pathetically grateful that it's like, oh, wow, this movie looks like something. It is actually like it is enjoyable, like, to put into my eyes.
Yeah.
There's so few movies at that level that is true of right now.
Absolutely. So. Yeah. And he accomplishes that. And, you know, he's a cinephile. And so you just have the feeling that it's not just this concocted kind of plasticized kind of thing. Obviously, he's super conscious of past, going back to Brick. I mean, he's super conscious of kind of past ways to talk about a detective or a mystery.
Ryan is also a big, very vocal fan of The Last of Sheila, which is the Herbert Ross movie based on like the one play that Stephen Sondheim ever wrote. And so that is, for reasons that we won't spoil by getting into, but that is even more true of this movie. If The Last of Sheila is all over it.
Yes, absolutely. No, that's yeah. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah. Like the first movie, the wealthy people are pretty like insidious and not totally pleasant, which is an interesting thing to do. Cause it's not like you're enjoying their glamour or their wealth. You're watching them enjoy that wealth way too much on their own. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing that, yeah, again, not to give anything away about the plot, but there is just a general theme of like, what does it mean when you're all your friends are rich and you're just kind of in bed with them? And where does that lead you? And in as much as you can say a movie like Knives Out 2 has some sort of, I don't know, underlying idea in it, that for me was, that kind of came through. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree.
You agree. Succinctly. So yeah, and that's going to be coming out on Netflix. But wait, I hate to ask this, but someone like actually like emailed you about revealing who was in a Zoom call in like the first 10 minutes of the movie?
That is correct. Okay. Yes. Wow.
All right. You see what we have to deal with, the sacrifices we make. So yeah, so that's Glass Onion. And I just want to talk about a couple of other things. I don't know if you could just say like a little bit about a movie that got a lot of press for not necessarily the movie itself, but just the kind of industrial, you know, subversion phenomenon going on with The People's Joker, which I think only had one press screening. I don't know how many public screenings it had.
I think it might have screened for press twice, but definitely only had one public screening and had the midnight premiere. This is a movie by a trans director named Vera Drew, who also stars in it. And it's basically a sort of film length, I don't know, riff on subversion of homage to / attack on the sort of DC Batman universe, and particularly, of course, the character of the Joker. She plays the sort of aspiring stand-up comedian in Gotham City who goes through a character arc that sort of is both a kind of queer coming of age story and takes little pieces of both the Joker's and Harley Quinn's stories from, I think, maybe all the Batman movies those characters appears in. There are definitely scenes from numerous ones that are referenced and recreated. I think there might actually have been footage from the 2019 Joker movie in it at one point, but that was cut out before it actually screened. But it is Vera Drew. I think probably the most notable credit on this is that she has been an editor on several Tim and Eric projects on Adult Swim. And that kind of chaotic collage style is very much in evidence here. And I have to admit, I mean, I'm a person who cannot take too much of that when Tim and Eric do it either. So the movie definitely kind of wore on me in that respect. But, you know, the most noteworthy thing about it became that first, it was kind of amazing that this thing existed and was put in a major film festival. And based on the description, it was like, well, how far are they actually going to go here and just making a movie about the Joker? Like, clearly they're going to get sued by Warner Brothers, or they're going to get a letter or something. And apparently they did get a letter before the screening and, you know, worked it out with TIFF to basically do the one screening, have the midnight premiere, and then all the other screenings were canceled. Now all the other screenings at Fantastic Fest and I think a number of other festivals that it was booked in have been canceled as well, while they're sort of weighing their legal options. I mean, it does very clearly, to my amateur understanding, fall under fair use. I know that like trademark is a different issue and they are calling the character the Joker. There's like a Pink Floyd song and an Eminem song in this. And I know that those are going to be much trickier waters to navigate rights wise. But I do, the attack on the kind of copyright system and particularly the way it's been warped and, you know, contorted over the years to keep this character who is now the character of the Joker is now 82 years old. Everyone who created it is dead. But because it's now owned by this, you know, functionally immortal corporation, and they keep every time the copyright extensions are about to run out, they get a bill into Congress to extend them for another 50 years. They will kind of own the rights for this thing forever. But that's, you know, not what copyright was intended to do at the first place. It was intended to protect the artists who are no longer around to be protected. And wouldn't be profiting from this thing if they weren't. Mm. So sort of deeply sympathetic to it and supportive of it. Well, also, if you kind of back me into a corner and force me to admit it, then really like the movie all that
much. Well, that's what I'm here for, to back you into a corner and make you admit things about the movies.
I think it's an interesting document. I do know, I have, spoken to and read stuff by a number of trans critics who found it really inspiring in a number of ways, both for the personal aspect of it, but just for the way it is really, quite literally queering this still very like cloistered and unprogressive comic book universe that has, got such a kind of stranglehold on the movie marketplace and the discourse. This is, the fact that this movie was shut down by Warner Brothers, which is also the company that just shelved an entirely almost completed Batgirl movie, which would have introduced the sort of the first, I believe the first trans character to be played by a trans actress into the kind of Batman cosmos. And they just decided that they would rather take the tax break and declare a complete loss on it than release this movie.
Yeah.
I think that irony kind of can't be overstated. And these are the companies that keep telling us, like Marvel, it's like, by the way, just so you know, Tessa Thompson's character in the Thor movies is bisexual. Like, we're never going to actually get around to like showing you ever having a relationship with a woman, but in her head, she is. They're so far behind moving the ball to like where, so many people in this country and around the world already are. Mm-hmm. That a movie like this that is really just like, yeah, you know what? We're not going to wait around anymore. Like, this is ours, both, legally and artistically. We have the right to do this. We're going to take control of it and do what we want to do with it and make it actually mean something. I mean, I think there are more ideas in this movie for mostly for good, but there are more ideas in 90 minutes of the Joker movie than there are in like the entire DC movie cosmos combined.
Yeah, that does make the movie much more interesting. I mean, the touchstones I'd heard for it were like Tarnation. But when I first heard about it, I thought about this movie. Do you remember this Flooding with Love for the Kid? This kind of like one man retelling of Rambo or something?
I do not. Oh, actually, that rings like a vaguely a bell. Actually, once you bring up Rambo, yeah. Or I mean, I made the comparison to Todd Haynes's Superstar as well, which I don't think this artistically measures up to, but I think the impulse is very much the same. And I think that's a, totally legitimate and interesting way of approaching it.
Yeah. So that's The People's Joker, which, yeah, it's not going to suddenly be like retitled The People's Laugher or Smoker or something.
That would so not help at this point. I mean, I know that they are, very determined to push forward with the movie and find some way to let people see it legally. I think they've gotten a lot of attention at this point. I'm hoping that, some fair use lawyers they have legal counsel on the film already. They have like a full screen credit in the movie, but hopefully they're getting more assistance. And I think hopefully that will allow people to see it at some point.
Yeah. And I mean, it is a sort of accomplishment for the programmer. I mean, they obviously don't go blindly into this. So, I know they must do preparations to make sure that it's possible for it to exist in the world in some way, just even for those two screens that it did. So that's also interesting. So maybe we can wrap up with just go right to a big highlight for you in the festival, the Laura Poitras film, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. And this is one that I also really loved. But so I'd love to hear what you liked about it.
I mentioned the experience right at the beginning of starting off in the festival being like, well, where's my masterpiece? Like, where's the great movie? And the first one that I came across was All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. This is, as I think you've discussed on the podcast before, but this is, there's sort of two things going on. One is a pretty interesting and moving, but pretty straightforward story of Nan Golden, the sort of legendary photographer, fighting back against the opioid crisis, in particular the Sackler family, and the way that they have used their wealth to basically kind of launder the family name by putting their names on, particularly museum wings in the art world, and things like that to get around the fact that they knowingly sold deadly addictive drugs to people for decades. And because Nan Goldin has her photographs in the permanent collections of so many of these museums, she really has a voice and a position to get them to pay attention to this. So that's kind of the one story that's sort of more typical, like activist documentary fare. But what Poitras does is really interesting is she gets us into it through that, and she gives us some background on Nan Goldin's life and how she grew up. And then the movie kind of takes a big detour, or, you know, shift into just a very solid biographical chunk of Nan Goldin's life kind of living up to this. And some of that is, you know, her own experience with addiction, both using and growing up around addicts around in New York and Boston in the 70s and 80s. But it becomes, in a subtle but really moving way for me, a chronicle of sort of the interaction between her life and art and activism, and the way that the same impulse that basically it's this kind of WASP repression that allows the, you know, Sacklers to kind of maintain this elevated social standing while profiting massively off this enormous public health crisis, is also what manifested in Goldin's family, particularly with she and her sister being queer and her parents not being able to deal with that, and that really leaving a mark on her. So it just becomes about, you know, her priorities and her means of expression shifting over, you know, the decades that she's been an artist and an activist, how those things interplay, how, you know, she has kind of become maybe wiser and more strategic in, you know, her later years. All the people that she has, because of drugs and AIDS, all the people that she has survived, you know, over this time, and just now feels like she's fighting for as well. So it just does like a really interesting thing for me, which is it's taking this one very straightforward story and this one really kind of windy, messy biographical story and weaving them together without simplifying one or just using one to kind of prop up the other. And so that feels very true to just kind of the way that people's lives work out in the ways that they don't necessarily expect.
Yeah, I know. It's also just kind of, I don't want to use the word magical, but whenever a movie kind of accomplishes something that a lot of movies try all the time to do, and it just pulls it off, I guess it seems like a kind of magic to me.
Right.
Yeah, and in this case, it's more or less really what so many documentaries try to do, which is, you know, convince you of, not that the movie is like trying to convince you, but convince you of the way an artist is transforming their life and drawing on their life and the world and what they went through, et cetera, et cetera, and how it, you know, changes the world. This is a movie that actually portrays that and actually communicates that. And it really hit home for me. It's just kind of a question of, you have pain in life and some have more pain than others. And then the question is, what happens to that? What do you do with it? How do you express it? And it just becomes very stark, the difference between an artistic pursuit versus really vile mercenary profiting off of pain. And obviously I'm talking about like different kinds of pain there, but just in that kind of general equation to me was really fascinating, to have them put starkly next to each other. And I just felt it very, very deeply, the ethos that she has, this kind of open-hearted candor, wherever it takes you and however much it exposes you to just go deeper, you know, with yourself and with other people. That's what Nan Goldin is doing. And then, yeah, the flip side being everything that has happened through the opioid profiteering.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you see so many documentaries try to do this, and often in a much sort of more forceful and heavy-handed way, and fall short because of this. And I think this is a really kind of subtle and sophisticated movie that I actually look forward to watching, you know, another time or two, because I think the way that it unfolds really was something that I only kind of came together in my mind after I saw it, because it's not at all kind of showy or demonstrative about what it's doing. It really just lets it creep up on you. And I think that's extraordinarily well done.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also as a New York movie, also impressive, which is, you know, also a very hard thing to do at this stage with that. There's this same slice of New York history that in the 70s, even just the late 70s, that has been like endlessly sliced and diced across documentaries in the past, you know, 15, 20 years. And it still uncovered things that I didn't, you know, even the idea of an after hours bar. I love that that is pretty central to some part of her experience. So I appreciated that as well. And yeah, not a surprise I felt from Poitras, who I generally feel is always kind of looking for the goods and is not going to be content with kind of reheating stuff. But that's All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, which won the top prize at Venice, notable because it's a documentary, and then went on to Toronto and is, I guess, one of the sort of tentpole screenings at the New York Film Festival. So that should be a special event too.
It's going to be very interesting to, I mean, I almost want to see it again there just because the opening scene of the movie is this protest of the Sackler Wing at the Met Museum, which is, I don't know what, half a mile from the Walter Reed or something like that. So I like that. I was just sort of picturing that even though I was watching it in Canada, I was kind of picturing that juxtaposition in my head and thinking about how it would land in those theaters. And that's very interesting to me.
Yeah. It also just has layers to it. It's more than just what sometimes is the kind of requisite layer of a documentary. Let's show something they're doing now. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see it in another monumental institutional space. But I think that'll bring us to the end. Any final word or?
No, I mean, thank you. I really appreciate you asking me on to do this. It turned out to be a pretty good tiff for me in the end. Saw a bunch of good movies, ate a lot of poutine.
Yes, essential to get poutine. I also just want to direct people to your writing at Slate. So you wrote about like 3 or 4 different kind of phenomena from the festival, right?
I mean, the things I wrote about from that, I wrote about the People's Joker, which we discussed. I wrote a little bit about Steven Spielberg's The Fablemans and also Joanna Hogg's The Eternal Daughter, which is one of my favorite movies there. And then just a little thing about Godard died in the middle of the festival. And I'd just seen the episode of documentary Now that's there, that is kind of a Agnes Varda pastiche and does some sort of interesting riffing on the end of Faces Places, where she gets stood up by Godard and actually ends up being this really kind of sweet tribute in a way that show is particularly good at. So those were my 3 TIFF pieces this year.
Great. All right. Well, we'll wrap up there. And I guess I'll see you at the next festival, which is probably at New York.
Yeah, like next week. Yep.
All right.
See you soon, Nick.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.